Chapter 12. Chris. This is not going to get weird. The word from Aklu's minions was that Rollo should bring someone to speak for him. The hegemony firmly believed that leaders had menials to do the talking for them. Chris volunteered for the honour. It was, after all, her job. Kit handled the money, she handled the people. There is no reason this has to be weird. She'd sat with urbane killers in tailored shirts with ruffled fronts, who had sipped from tiny glasses and talked theatre and ballet engagements while ordering the deaths of faithless minions and minor civic functionaries. They liked her overall. She knew the line they wanted women to tread. She'd gone before a broken-nosed man whose huge frame was 50% augmented artificial muscle. He'd conducted business at an arena so he could watch his stable of gladiators tearing apart robots and sometimes each other. That had gone okay too. She knew a thing or two about the fighter's form, and that had endeared her to the man. She'd been granted an audience by a Castigar Don, warrior caste, a segmented worm 5 metres long, each ring of its annular body bristling with spines. Its tentacled head had been painted with jagged symbols, suggesting violence to human eyes as eloquently as to its own kind. Each squirming arm of its crown had been capped with a chattering set of mechanised blades mounted below the reddish bead of the eye. She had faced up to that horrifying cutlery draw and outlined the drop-off the vulture god wanted to make. She'd offered a cut of their paycheck, and they'd made a deal. There was always a deal. Some criminals were sadists or psychopaths, but most weren't. Even the ones who were generally preferred largesse to killing potential contacts, and she'd never caught any of them on a bad enough day. It had never turned weird. Yet. The broken harvest was holed up in a crumbling dormitory, in the wretched upper levels of the same city where Threnikos lived in such luxury. It was a sprawling, heavily rad-shielded eyesore of a building, erected for the first constructor crews back before. The blocks around it were slums, filled with those who couldn't afford anywhere else. No hulking mercenaries patrolled these streets, and 1,000 little gangs and fraternities formed and died there nightly. The harvest itself was no major player on Tarakuma, as far as Chris could tell. It was based within the hegemony, a thorn in the shelly ass of the Esiel. Probably this Aklu was not the actual leader of the gang, or sect, or suicide cult, or whatever they actually were. Aklu might just be their word for a branch manager. But even if Tarakuma hosted only a fraction of their power, she soon realised that still meant something on these streets. When she and Rollo left their taxi shuttle, one of this Aklu's people had turned up to meet them. She wore an unimpressive old tunic, bulked out with some sort of armour coating, but Chris stiffened when she looked closer. The woman's armour was slashed down the centre of her back, revealing the articulated lobster thing rooted to her spine. Another Tothiat, like the murderous son of a bitch who'd stolen their ship. And weren't they supposed to be rare? And this Tothiat carried an actual standard, a pole with an honest-to-God flag hanging from it. It boasted a crooked black sunburst on grey, or else it was a figure with many arms poised in some manner of dance. Whatever its meaning, people crossed the street or dived into alleys when they saw that flag coming. This might just be the broken harvest's fingertip here on Tarakuma, but these streets were under the society's shadow. Their guide was Hairamon, she said, and Chris recalled that their hijacker, of unfond memory, had been Mesmon. There was no other family resemblance beyond the lobster. Still doesn't have to get weird, she thought, as Hermon led them to that hideous concrete eyesore. Then they were inside, past a dozen humans and a couple of Hani crowding out the atrium. They descended rough steps, still uneven and walled where they'd been inexpertly printed, and came out into a big chamber, ranks of pillars propping up the ceiling. One wall was lined with desks of humans and Hani at work, probably doing nothing more sinister than double-entry bookkeeping. Another wall was lined with armed guards, humans and Castigar molted into oddly proportioned humanoid bodies. At the far end of the room, however, Chris blinked. It had got weird. At her side, Rollo swore softly. Hermon stepped forward, and her voice rang from the bare concrete walls. "The unspeakable Aklu, the razor and the hook." There were actually two entities coming forward. One was a hiver frame, like no other Chris had ever seen. Their torso was open as a birdcage, revealing the seething knot of biomechanical roaches that made up their composite being. Their head was a golden human mask, set into a contemptuous laughing expression. They walked on long digitigrade legs like a bird, waving six slender arms. The whole looked like a surrealist take on an ancient god. None of this was what had caught Chris and Rollo's attention. Behind the hiver was the unspeakable Aklu, without a doubt. It was gliding forwards on a great mechanized couch that curved in silvery wings either side of its occupant, held a half meter off the floor by its own A-Grav engine. Aklu was one of the Esiel, god rulers of the hegemonic cultists, lord of the hegemony itself, and apparently a gangster. Chris remembered the august Esiel diplomat sent to Hue Kavor. It had possessed a string of titles too, revered this and wonderful that. They were human labels, she knew, but they were supposed to reflect some deep Esiel truths. So what did it mean for an Esiel to be unspeakable, a razor, and a hook? Aklu was primarily shell, the two curved halves hinged at the base and overlapping for most of their 3 meter height. They divided towards the top, cupping the motile parts of the creature. Its hard exterior seemed to be inscribed with complex geometric runes, picked out in what looked like channels of mercury, constantly flowing in defiance of any native gravity. A wrinkled holdfast projected from its base to wind around the couch's projections and hold the creature in place. From the top of the shell, a multitude of thin arms opened like a fan, bristling with hairs and pincers. 3 eyes like red pearls moved at the end of jointed stalks, viewing Aklu's visitors from all sides. Chris was very afraid now, and not entirely sure why. If it was a gangster, and the Broken Harvest a gang, this should be like any other negotiation. Except she'd never dealt with an Esiel before. Nobody she knew had. Human representatives of the hegemony, like Sathiel, were the closest anybody ever came. Esiel were not supposed to be squatting in concrete bunkers, surrounded by desperados. At the same time, some screaming part of her was telling her, "It's a giant clam. What's the worst it could do?" Except... she'd always dismissed those cultists who fervently attributed divinity to their shelly masters. Standing in the presence of this creature now, there was something about it. The unspeakable Aklu's arms flurried through a complex sequence of postures, and Chris felt a rumble through the soles of her feet, resounding back from the walls to her body, without ever reaching her ears. Only in retrospect did she realise that Aklu was being conversational. The hiver started into motion, making an elaborate leg like a dancer, then straightening up. Chris noticed that they had two faces, one smiling gold mask facing them, and one with a downturned mouth facing away, a mask of tragedy. Then their half-dozen golden arms adopted a series of elegant poses, and their bell-like voice rang out. "So step the sanctified within our halls, who walked with eyeless tread the hidden glade. Peruse them, linger on each page of theirs, and verdict give on how they have transgressed." The only operative word in all of that was transgressed, as far as Chris was concerned. She froze, ready to fight, as Heremon came forward with some kind of device pointed right at them. For a wild moment, she considered the ultimate sacrilege, leaping up on that couch with her knife, threatening oyster suppers for everyone unless they let her and Rollo out. But what Heremon was holding didn't look like a gun. The symbiont woman shook her head slightly in her direction. A cue for her to be silent? Then the hiver adopted a new posture with their many arms, briefly mirrored by their floating master, before gesticulating again. "Sweet tones of innocence attend, for these, the masters of the carrion bird, have not defiled the sanctuaries of God, nor placed a hand on that which is forbidden." The hiver's beautiful voice rang out against the cracked and filthy walls, and a dozen armed thugs and murderers listened raptly, as though it all made perfect sense. Then Rollo nudged her, none too gently. Chris had absolutely no idea what mad etiquette held sway here, but she cleared her throat. "We are but poor supplicants to the unspeakable Aklu. We are the, yes, the masters of the carrion bird, the crew of the vulture god, the ones that recovered the Umaru." Aklu's arm semaphored, and she stopped. Speaking over the unspeakable was probably a faux pas of epic proportions. The gilded hiver adopted another sequence of ritualistic poses, pirouetting again to show them their frowning, tragedic face. "Our ark, our rightful casket, treasure fleet of all our dreams. Explain how you, a nithing, with desecrating tread, defiled our joy." Which sounded bad, however you sliced it. Chris shared a look with Rollo, then described their brief involvement with the Umaru. It was a broken harvest ship. That hadn't been in the brief, but it wasn't as though most gangs made things easy for Hugh law enforcement by putting their criminal identities on the owner's manifest. When she described the wrecked Umaru's appearance, Aklu moved again, and she let her account slow. The hiver melodiously asked her to repeat it, and then again, in more detail. And again, until Chris just about ran out of ways to say the same thing. "It had been peeled. We've all seen how it was from the war. Melted and reformed. Made into a sculpture, as they do. You know what I mean." "How sour false witness falls upon the ear," the hiver remarked. Then abruptly, Heremon did have a gun, and it was pressed to Chris's temple. Three of the thugs tackled Rollo to the ground in a struggling heap, and in the distraction, Chris whipped out her knife and slashed Heremon's throat. Before her eyes, the shallow cut healed up. Heremon didn't seem to be remotely bothered, her gun hand steady. Rollo was hollering furiously, and with a Herculean effort, he dragged his whole tangle of aggressors half a metre closer to the couch.
"I just want my ship!" he was howling. "My ship, you fucking barnacle! You killed my people! You stole my ship!"
Chris felt all possible chance of salvaging the situation falling out of the world's ass, as the saying went. She met Heremon's gaze past the glint of her knife, still at the Tothiat's throat, and saw only unfriendly disinterest. For her, exploding Chris's head with a bullet would be a mildly disagreeable task, akin to scraping something off her sandal. Chris felt it was all over. They weren't leaving here alive. But Aklu must have had something more to say, because the Hiver chimed, "Compounding sin with sin, bad faith with faith, to stand before the unspoken throne and claim a right to hold the Ark of the Divine." Chris was hit with a sudden jolt of inspiration. They'd raced here before Aklu's people, so the gangster wouldn't know how things had gone down. And so they'd misunderstood her explanation. Hardly surprising, given its unusual nature.
"We don't mean the Amaru," she managed. "Rollo, be still. We don't lay claim to that. We want our ship. When your people reclaimed your property, they grabbed the Vulture God to transport theirs. The Amaru, it wasn't going anywhere on its own, see? We just came to ask, to very respectfully ask, when the unspeakable Aklu has reclaimed its ark, property, whatever, might we have, maybe, our own ship back?" She bit down on any further pleading and waited, body still taut as a wire. Rollo had called the Essiel a barnacle, but nobody seemed to be shouting about that. Possibly it had been translated as something more complimentary, and she hadn't mentioned Barney or Medvig, who couldn't just be returned peaceably to them. However, right now, coming out of this alive themselves seemed a long shot. The Unspeakable's arms waved as though in a breeze that touched nothing else, and its eyes popped up and down. Its Hiver mouthpiece was still, balanced perfectly on one foot, the other drawn up mid-pose, and their fan of arms motionless. Chris guessed that it was plugged into Tarakuma's Kybernet, sending out inquiries to confirm her story. Then, the Hiver jolted back into motion, saying, "You carry in your hearts the go-between, who stands between destroyer and destroyed," which could only mean Idris, the intermediary. Chris wondered if she was starting to get the hang of this. The arms waved again, hypnotically. "What once the gods have seized on, none may claim. And yet divine benevolence is such that all who kneel devoutly at their feet and hold the cup of charity aloft may live in expectation of reward," the Hiver pronounced. Abruptly, Heremon had stepped back, and the goons were allowing Rollo to stand again.
"What, my child?" the captain growled softly. "What, frankly, the fuck did any of that mean?"
And a silence stretched out, a cue for her to answer in some way. "I think," Chris replied very quietly, "they mean that they've got our ship, and so it's theirs. But if we work for them, maybe we can have it back eventually, I think. And they were talking about Idris. So they want him for deep void diving?"
"Is that all?"
She saw Rollo's face twitch with all the rage he was holding back.
"And my two dead children? Do we get them back too, after we've bowed and scraped and done their filthy work? Did they say that?"
"Rollo,
we become their lackeys and just forget they murdered our people, my daughter. And if we're very, very good and kiss their shellfish ass, they might just let me have my own damn ship back some day.
All said with white-hot fury, and yet still in the merest whisper. Despite everything, she was impressed that he was being so restrained. Chris cast a glance towards the motionless Hiver and their floating master. She was all too aware of the expectant killers on every side. At the desks, the clerks continued with their work, diligently defrauding, counterfeiting, or whatever their duties involved.
"Say what you've got to say,"
Rollo ground out, and Chris took a deep breath. "We are, of course, honoured by your offer to serve the unspeakable," she declared brightly. "We will take this to the rest of the crew immediately. Thank you for your munificence." Ordinarily, she'd have been overdoing it, but right now she was in the asylum of aggrandisement, and no praise could be too much. She even bowed. If she was echoing a scintillant fencer's respect to an opponent before somebody got cut up, nobody there was likely to recognise it. "Consider all you will," the Hiver said. "The vulture's leash shall not be lightly shed. But we have faith that you shall come in all humility to pledge us service and begin the path to restitution." Chris looked sidelong at Hermon and the heavies. She was seeking confirmation from any of them that they found this bizarre show even a little odd. She wanted to burst, like a child calling out a naked emperor. But there was not the slightest crack in their masks of respect. She felt as though she'd fallen through the wrong side of the mirror. 2 minutes later, she and Rollo were on the street, hides miraculously intact, save for the odd bruise. The captain's expression was thunderous as she called the rest of the crew. Somehow, Chris didn't think a long and mutually profitable partnership with the Broken Harvest was on the cards. After they'd returned to the Dark Jones docking bay, Rollo sat by himself and brooded. Chris had expected him to explode. A quietly seething captain was somehow worse. Chris had explained the situation to everyone else, especially Idris. He had a right to know that yet another unscrupulous bunch of thugs was interested in him. She half expected him to start plotting a course to anywhere but Tarakuma, but instead, he kicked his heels on the ramp to the Jones cockpit and watched Rollo unhappily. "This might be it for us," Chris said, meaning for them as a crew, a surrogate family. "I don't imagine the Parthenon will let us pal around in this speedster much longer." Idris nodded, eyes still on Rollo. "You've heard Solace out yet?"
"Not exactly," he said softly. "And to her credit, she's not pressed it. But all this that she's done for us is just to sweeten me up."
"You could do worse, you know." He glanced at her in surprise, almost betrayed, and she hurried to add, "I'm not trying to get rid of you, Idris. I'm just saying, if they made me a good offer, I'd go."
"Do you want to go?"
"I want to have options. And if the Parthenon want a colonial law advocate, well, they'd be interesting employers. For a bit."
"And if it's not just for a bit?" "Nobody in the Parthenon is employed, Chris. They don't have jobs. They have duty. And you don't get to pick and choose who you do duties for. I'm sure you don't get to say, 'Well, nice doing my duty for you. Now I'm off to work for the colonies again.'"
His face twisted unhappily, and he looked at his feet.
"I guess I should hear her out, though, then send her away,"
You like her?
We went through a lot in the war. We were close after Berlinhof, before she rejoined her unit. I needed someone, and she... I don't know what she wanted.
Why not just the same as you?
I don't think Parthenia like that, are they? Or that warrior spirit and selfless sacrifice. I don't think they need shoulders to cry on, like regular human beings. They edit that shit out of them in the vats. Or what's the point? What's the point of making better people if they're still sad and afraid and lonely?
Chris saw the signs and put her arms around him, letting him sag into her. A half minute later, and he was fine, backing away, his expression all apology. She smiled, squeezed his shoulder to show she didn't mind. It was that continuous lack of sleep, she knew. Things that the mind would normally disarm and dismantle, built up inside him, and he couldn't bar the door against them forever. Then he shifted hurriedly to one side because Rollo was coming through. He marched up the ramp into the Joan with such a grim purpose that Chris thought he might just fly the ship away himself and leave them all behind. To seek vengeance. To find the vulture. Who could guess, in his state? The others were clearly worried about him too. So when Rollo put his head back out, his whole crew was waiting.
Right, my wastrels, he addressed them. These pods, all this nonsense.
A jab at the rack of suspension beds the Partheni technician had installed.
They come out, right? They're just bolted in there.
Solis nodded, cautiously. Rollo grunted thoughtfully, a man stalking a mad idea through dense brush.
Idris, how long before the vulture comes in system?
Idris slipped his slate out and ran a few hurried calculations.
Any time from now to 12 hours' time, depending on how tight their nav is.
There's no Partheni embassy on Tarakuma. Not a formal one, Solis started tentatively. But I could...
No,
Rollo told her sharply. He pressed his lips together and went on apologetically.
Not to disparage what you've done for us, my child. But no, this is spacer business, our business. Too much gratitude starts to look like ownership. I'm sorry.
Understood. Although from her expression, the Partheni plainly didn't understand. Chris considered that she came from a place where everyone was pointed in the same direction, and everyone helped everyone else. Or maybe they were all horribly competitive all the time, and Chris's fond idea of Partheni life was entirely bunkum. Rollo took a deep breath.
This you can do for me, though. My adopted daughter. You tell me what weapons this bird here has. Talk me through it.
Chris felt a lurch inside her. Rollo, she said, overlapping with Ollie's.
Captain! Let's call it an academic exercise. See right?
Rollo said with false joviality. Solis looked from him to the rest of them and stepped up to lean into the cockpit. Twin accelerators here. Not much against any serious defences, but good. Good for light work. Ready ammo's limited, but there's a mass stripping system that'll keep them fed at the expense of, well, mass. Mass from the end segments. There's a single narrow-beam laser that can be powered from the reaction drives. I think... 7 minutes continuous burn at full power before you're dry. The gravitic drive isn't adapted for offensive deployment, but it's good for shielding, and segmentation defences are built in too.
I don't even know what that means, Rollo told her briskly. Quite the little gunboat you've loaned us there, child. Right now, you're the favourite of my family.
His smile was bleak.
Captain, what's the plan?
Ollie asked him. He stood on the ramp, irresolute for a few moments, and then sat at the edge of the Jones hatch to confront his crew, hands clasped in his lap.
Chris told you all the nonsense we went through down there. Crazy shellfish wants to own us. Let us earn our own ship back by doing its shit work. Wants to own Idris too. And I know how those deals go. You never do earn out on a contract like that. Once owned, always owned.
Chris nodded, and everyone else was of the same mind. If you got in with the mob, you didn't just walk away. Not unlike what Idris had been saying about the Parthenon, but she knew where she'd rather take her chances.
So, my vulture comes in system in a few hours, most likely. So says our Idris. Then they bring it here, repurpose it, strip it. Who knows? Who knows what they want with the Umaru, even? Which crazy shellfish says it owns? None of our business. We don't want it, that much I do know. But the vulture is my bird, and I am getting her back. Because the Parthenon, all gods help us, has given us a fighting ship.
They stared. Probably most of them had seen the direction he was pulling in, but to hear it said out loud was flat-out madness.
Idris, you flew in the war, Rollo said. And Solis, you were a pilot.
Gunnery, the Partheni said soberly. But I can fly.
We strip out this junk.
A thumb jerked at the suspension pods.
We tool up with what we can get. We intercept the fuckers, hack the vulture's doors open, cut with a laser if we have to. We take back our ship before it hits orbit and piss right off out of this system and never look back.
Kittering raised his shield arms urgently. Also, Broken Harvest are made enemies forever.
They killed Barney and Medvig,
Rollo reminded him flatly.
They are no friends of ours. And I want my ship back.
His shoulders sagged a little.
And this is dangerous stuff, my kiddos. My fry. Nothing you signed up for. You want to make your own way? We can drop you at an orbital. Ships go from here to everywhere, every day. Kit will cash you out. You'll not go hungry. You can cash yourself out too, Kit, if that's what you want. I'll hold it against nobody. None of you told me, pirate, when I asked you what skills you brought.
I'm in, Ollie said, almost before he'd finished. Captain, I will cut that Tothiat bastard a new asshole. I am in.
It'll just heal up again, thought Chris, recognising a thread of hysteria within herself. She looked at Idris, surely the least martial of all of them. He was looking back at her. They came as a pair, after all.
Think about it, Rollo told them. Nobody's arm gets twisted on this. No shame in walking away.
Though every one of them who dropped out would be a hole below the waterline in the plan's chances of success. There was a spacer's dive near the Castigar patrolled dock where they'd holed up, and Chris and Idris retreated there to mull it over. Ollie stayed with the Joan, already ripping out the suspension beds so they'd have somewhere to muster prior to the proposed action.
I think Kit will bail, Chris told Idris,
when they ducked into a corner booth with beakers of acrid fake cafe. He nodded, not looking at her, or at anything really, just staring into infinity, in that way he did. So she continued.
I think the Partheni, I don't know. I mean, she probably trained for this sort of thing. All second nature. She, Rollo and Ollie could likely do this with blood to spare. Not her fight, though. But she... I think she really wants to be one of us, you know.
which is weird, given she's basically a secret agent for a foreign government.
She's a terrible spy, Idris said, with the ghost of a smile.
Chris took a slug of cafe and instantly regretted it. Too hot, way too nasty. Idris, I will walk away with you. If you don't want to do this, I'll go. We're a team.
But,
he eyed her cagily, I don't want to walk. She couldn't read him at all in that moment. Then at last he said,
I thought you'd be pulling me the other way. I thought, of all of us, you'd have the good sense to have nothing to do with this. I thought we'd be having this conversation in reverse.
You mean you...
I want to back up Rollo. I want to get closure on Barney and Medvig. I don't want to kill anyone, but I want our ship back too.
A lifetime of trouble's going to come out of this. Aklu seemed to feel pretty strongly about this whole business. Idris gave her a frank look.
I give not the least fuck what some renegade Essiel wants with a torn-up wreck. I just want to do right by Rollo and be back on the Vulture.
When Rollo returned to the bay, with a crate gliding along behind him, he found everyone there but Kittering. The absence hit him. Chris saw it in his wry smile.
Not bad, though, he admitted, looking at the remainder of his crew. Children, I have toys for you. Dangerous toys. Not many, but it was short notice. And we need a plan of attack. Battle Daughter, can you do that for us?
Solis tapped at her temple. I've been working on it already, Captain.
You are the favourite of all my brood,
Rollo told her, trying for his old good nature, but the sharp edges were showing through. Then there was a rapid pattering of feet, and Kittering scuttled in, screens showing clashing, alarmed colours.
Kit?
Rollo asked. Vulture in system, Kittering's translator barked, and he lit up with simulations, telemetry and projections. Barely 3 hours had passed since Idris had made his prediction.
Ollie,
Rollo barked.
Beds are almost out, nearly ready.
The remote specialist loomed at the hatch. She was already in her Scorpion for the heavy work and would be taking up half the available standing room behind the pilot's seat. Attention, Kit announced. Another vessel has launched on a course for the Vulture Umaru. More lines arced across his display. Chris took a moment to work out what she was seeing. The Vulture had exited Unspace, but it wasn't hauling its prize anywhere near Tarakuma or the orbitals. It was staying discreetly out of the way towards the system's further reaches. Aklu must be sending a ship to get whatever he wanted off his Ark, the Umaru, without the architected wreck causing an outcry.
Can we outstrip them? Rollo demanded. Ollie, finish up double time. Don't worry about sharp edges or loose wires.
They're going out full burn. Solis had taken in the figures Kit was streaming.
We can outstrip them.
Idris's voice was flat. He looked a little sick at whatever idea had just come to him.
We'll do this, Rollo. Now, before my nerve goes. Kit?
Rollo looked at the Hanny. Yes, my captain, Kittering confirmed. His screens displayed a sequence of complex patterns, oranges and pinks and greys, but his eloquence was beyond human comprehension this time. Then Ollie had dumped the last of the beds out the hatch and backed up to give them room. With his brisk, many-legged stride, Kit pattered up the ramp into the Joan. The rest of them followed. The game was on.